You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also designs and hosts Virginia history programs for the Charlottesville Senior Center. In the fall of 2010, the Senior Center offered one of Rick's programs entitled Virginia History 101, running from October 7th through November 18th. This six-part lecture series was designed for those interested in Virginia's fascinating early history. The November 4th, 2010 talk, George Washington and His Presidency, was delivered by David Hoth. David is the editor of the Papers of George Washington and a former editor of the papers of Presidents James K. Polk and Andrew Jackson. Using his extensive knowledge of both Jackson and Washington, Hoth commences with some interesting compare and contrast anecdotes. Both presidents had gained fame as military commanders, and Jackson saw himself as a Washington-like hero, but George Washington exhibited much more control and restraint, and his political abilities have been greatly underestimated. Washington cared a bit about money, but he was not motivated by power. What was the driving engine behind his presidency? This is the fifth in a six-part series for 2010. Here's David Hoth.
I don't want to duplicate what I understand Ed told you about the project itself, but I do want to talk a little bit about the nature of historical editing and what we're doing, because I want you to understand why I'm going to treat this topic the way I'm going to treat it. What we do is these projects, all of which are very long-term, have gathered from around the world, literally around the world. We have papers from Russia, from Japan, from all of the European countries, as well as just about every place in America, and a lot of private letters have been given copies to us, printouts. And having gathered those, we are publishing them in what is going to eventually be a 100-volume set. And the way we go about that is we block off a period of space that fills up a volume because we're committed to a comprehensive edition. And we, edit those volumes, which means we transcribe the words as clearly as we can so we know exactly what's being said, and then we try and explain what every little detail in those volumes that we think might be obscure to people is. Well, the effect of this is if you've got three or four editors, as we do in the Washington papers, that you end up knowing an enormous amount about some parts of Washington's career. I know an enormous amount about a couple of months at Valley Forge and an enormous amount about the first effort to combine with the French in an expedition against Rhode Island when the French first came into the war because I was working on those Revolutionary War volumes. I know an enormous amount right now, because I'm working on it right now, about Washington and his response to the people out west who were upset with the whiskey tax and the so-called whiskey rebellion in Western Pennsylvania, I'm sorry, and what he was doing out there. Other parts, I know what a general historian would know, but probably not enormously more than that. And however, the one thing that I think that we do know, that we really know, and we don't get enough chance to talk about, is by working with this person's writing and this person's correspondence back and forth with everybody about a wide variety of subjects, I think we get to know what type of a person these individuals that we work on are better than most people. But because the nature of our discipline is to provide factual and non-directive information, in other words, we're not the historians who are expected to take sides. We're the historians who are expected to give you the facts, ma'am, nothing but the facts, like Joe Friday. And consequently, we don't talk as much as perhaps we should about what we think we know about the people that we know that we're dealing with. So what I want to do today is talk really more about what type of a man Washington is than giving you a history of his presidency. I want to do that. I'll come back to his presidency. I want to, in particular, address the issue of did he want to be president and the issue of what was that with his retirement at the end. But I want to kind of work my way into that by addressing what type of a man Washington was. Let me start, however, by at the presidency. If you look at the ratings that people give of presidents, you know, it's a common thread. It's always popular to try and do it. It appears in magazines from time to time, either historians' ratings or various other people's ratings. Almost inevitably, people will rank Washington and Lincoln 1 and 2 in some order or another. Washington because he made the Union possible, quite literally, and Lincoln because he saved the Union. However, when people actually start writing histories about Washington's administration, about his presidency, it seems to me that Washington tends to sort of disappear. The presidency tends to be written in terms of the controversies between Alexander Hamilton on the one hand and our friend Thomas Jefferson on the other. It tends to be written in terms of these various men because they are, one, very, very ideological, and two, very, very prolific and excellent writers. And Washington, at least in part, saw his presidency as being something of a chief of staff operation, and he gave these people a lot of room to express themselves before he made his final decisions. And Washington just tends to disappear. It's as though he isn't really in charge. Of course he was in charge. And I want to talk about that to some degree. Part of that is a sense that it happened with Eisenhower, too. When somebody comes into the presidency from a military background, it happened with Eisenhower, it happened actually to a degree with Jackson as well, there's a tendency to think that they're not politicians, that they have no political acumen, and that therefore, again, to underestimate them as actual participants in the political process. That would be an enormous mistake in the case of George Washington. Because if you look at George Washington's career as a general, at least in my view, having done a couple of volumes on George Washington as a general, one of the things you find is that George Washington was not a Robert E. Lee who was a brilliant tactician at moving troops around. George Washington was not a great strategist. I just had a debate with one of my colleagues about whether he was a better than average strategist or just an average strategist, but he was an okay strategist. What Washington was, however, was as a general, what made him a great general was he understood the politics of the situation. Washington was a great political general, a great diplomatic general. Washington was the type of man who was able to charm the French, to prevent the frictions that took place in the wake of that failed expedition in Rhode Island that I studied in such detail from rupturing the alliance, because he knew how to both calm his fellow countrymen and to calm the French. He also was the man who could deal with the fact that when Virginians came up to New England to fight in Boston and try and drive the British out before the Battle of Bunker Hill and the like, that the Southerners were appalled at the discipline of the New England soldiers, and the New England soldiers were appalled at the Southerners. He was a man who was able to, again, find a way to keep those sides from that friction that even when he shared some of that sort of sense of, oh, really, what kind of soldiers are these? He was able to prevent that from coming out in the open and disrupting the sort of thing. Washington, one of the odd things that happens when we deal with Washington's papers is when Washington is actually fighting battles, when things are happening, we have less to talk about. There are fewer letters, there's less detail, there's less material going on. When we have an awful lot of time to talk about is when he's in winter quarters at places like Valley Forge. And we have a lot to talk about because what Washington is doing that time is acting as a politician, telling people, begging cajoling, explaining to people why they need to contribute, why the generals have his officers have to come back and not go on vacation, and they have to stay as he's staying at Valley Forge if possible. And if they're not staying, he has to talk them into coming back. He has to talk the soldiers into not deserting. And more, most importantly, he has to talk Congress and all of the congressmen who don't particularly want to spend money or do anything into giving him the supplies and the support that he needs to keep the army together. He's a master politician because he knows that as his army, he knows the limitations of the British position, as far away as they are, and the difficulties that they're going to have. And he knows that even though they can win lots of battles, if he can continue to keep his army in the field and continue to keep American morale up, they will eventually have to quit. And he's able to do that. Okay. I spent about half of my career dealing with Andrew Jackson, and now when I moved to George Washington, it was quite a shock. They're probably, well, actually, that's, you know, that's a little more odd sort of statement in some ways than you might expect, because one of Jackson's favorite gifts in the 1823, 1824 was a relic of George Washington's, given to him by one of Washington's relatives, distant cousins, cousins once removed, all that type of thing. And it was given to him because a lot of people saw Jackson as the second coming of Washington, a military hero who had saved the Union in the Battle of New Orleans, who was a straight shooter and who would restore the country to a proper sort of approach. And to be honest, Jackson felt that way a lot about himself, that he was a George Washington type of figure. Jackson's sort of an interesting guy. On the one hand, he sees himself as a Jeffersonian, which probably would have made Thomas Jefferson roll in his grave, or actually did make him roll in his grave before he died, because, of course, they overlapped for a good deal of time. But he also saw himself as a Washingtonian type figure. He was, one of his claims, one of the things that made him electable was he was the last president of the revolutionary generation. He was 13 or 14 when the revolution took place. He fought in a very minor way in the Carolinas had that claim as being the last of the revolutionary generation. In any case, they, however, are very, very different people. And in moving from Jackson to Washington, I moved from perhaps what is the most uncontrolled president in history to perhaps the most controlled president in history. Now, this is not to say that on the one hand, Andrew Jackson could not control himself. That's not true. In 1823, there's an enormous amount of correspondence. He is elected to the Senate. He chooses to run for the Senate because they have to get a senator who is an old enemy of Jackson's out of the Senate in order to show that he has the unanimous support of Tennessee. And they figured the only person, he and his advisors figured the only person who can beat this guy is Jackson himself. So he is, in fact, elected to the Senate from Tennessee. And then there he goes back east, and there are enormous sort of letters sort of crowing about how he's fooling all those guys who expected him to be this uncouth, uncivilized, loose cannon and show them that, you know, he can be both civilized and in control and things like that. At the same time, there's all these sort of private letters privately patting himself on the back for not killing Henry Clay. If you go through Washington, you can go years in Washington without getting the sort of not killing Henry Clay type of moment. Jackson could control himself, but in his private correspondence, he's one of the most colorful, loose cannon type of person you could ever have. Washington seems to always be in control. Let's leave that for a moment and let's look at something else. One thing that Washington and Jackson had in common was a serious interest in history and in the verdict of history. This is true of both of those men. It's also true, I think, to a large degree of the entire revolutionary generation. One of the things that keeps our projects going on and on and on and on until we hit 100 volumes eventually is that these people, and Washington even more than most, understood, believed, thought that they were doing something that was historic, that was important, that was vital for there to be a record of what was going on. And so they saved and saved and saved. Now, Jefferson, you probably know, is so notorious for the detailed notebooks that he kept. Washington convinced Congress to put money out to pay a group of clerks to copy all of his wartime correspondence as generals. So we have Varick transcripts of a lot of letters that we would not otherwise have that were copied by those clerks. Generally speaking, unless at the moment our Revolutionary War period is entering a period where they keep moaning, he must have lost a trunk because there are a lot of missing correspondence. But we have really remarkably few missing letters, it seems like to me, in comparison with what I encountered in the Polk papers or in the Jackson papers. And Jackson was like Washington. In fact, we know he lost one trunk. Jackson was like Washington in believing that he wanted to save everything so that we would have the verdict of history. It's interesting, though, that the sort of phrasing of the two is different. Jackson is convinced that he needs this in order to show that all of his enemies were wrong and that he was right and that he will be the expert. Washington is interested in developing the historical record of what the American people did in this important critical moment in time. So that there is a somewhat different interest in history, but there is this interest in history. And keep this in mind as I talk a little bit about the next sort of thing. When we talk about why people go into politics, if we leave out, you know, the nice thing, public service and all that stuff, and we try and think in a more cynical way, usually I think people would say that people go into politics either because they want power, because they want money, or because they want fame. Okay, so let's for a moment put Washington to that test and say, what did he want? Did he want power? Did he want money? Did he want fame? Exactly what did he want out of his politics? Well, I think we can begin with by saying, for the most part, it's pretty clear he didn't really value power. In fact, I think that's what I believe. This is my belief that the key to understanding George Washington as a president, as a man, as a general, as everything else, is that he is one of those rare people who value power very little. He had a lot of power. I suspect that one of the reasons he was able to amass the power that he did is because a lot of people, contemporaries, people who were very chary about giving power to other people and very powerful people themselves, recognized in him a man who was not likely to abuse power because he didn't care much about power. I mean, after all, his reputation among his contemporaries, and if you stop and think about it, his reputation in high schools today is at least part built on the notion that this is a man who twice gave up power. At the end of the Revolution, supposedly, he might have become, followed the Napoleonic thing, and become a dictator or a leader, and he willingly gave up the power. And at the end of the presidency, he supposedly, again, gave up this sort of, under the notion that no man should be president for life, he resigned after two terms and gave up, again, the power. So that's what his reputation. It's pretty clear in any case that power was not a driving force for George Washington. I just reject that altogether. Money is a much more complicated issue. There have been people not even starting with Charles Beard, but he's one of the best known historians who made that case. There still are people who could make a pretty good case that George Washington cared an awful lot about money. George Washington was from the lower end of the aristocracy of Virginia. His father was not wealthy. He was not wealthy. He married up. He cared a lot about money. His initial career was to become a surveyor. Becoming a surveyor was a good way to get to know what some of the best lands were out west and to acquire some of the best lands, and he became a land speculator. A lot of the policies that he espoused nationally are supportive of the notion of the West and would have been supportive of his land speculation. If you read his letters, you'll discover that he watches his money very closely, is the only way to put it. He's a man who believes that when he's not there to supervise at Mount Vernon, his slaves are taking advantage of him. His overseers are probably taking advantage of him. He's sure that the tenants on his western lands are taking advantage of him. He writes a letter to in 1794, period I'm working on right now, he writes a letter to one of his, a man that he's hiring as his household steward, and he says to this man that, all my household expenses hitherto have run so much beyond all calculation that I'm resolved to discover the cause, which according to my conception must proceed either from my having been charged for things that were not purchased, or from waste, or from being being taken away after they've been brought into the house. In other words, from theft, petty theft. Washington tells this same, gives to the same prospective steward his favorite adage, which is, many a mickle makes a muckle. It's a Scotch adage, and he explains, in this case, it actually is an adage that he uses in two ways, one of which is to talk about Washington was a very detail-oriented person, and it's important to pay attention to details. And so he talks about it in that way. In this way, he explains it in an economic sense. He says, many mickles make a muckle, indicating that however trifling a thing may be in itself when it stands alone, yet when they come to be multiplied, they mount high, which serves to prove that nothing, however trifling, ought to be wasted that can be saved, nor bought if you can well do without. Washington is a man whose accounts, surviving accounts, are among the most detailed of the founding fathers. In fact, we're about to embark, Bonnet may have talked about it, a new financial series to try and edit those accounts. There are bigger gaps in the accounts than other things, but there are three big ledger books and a lot in the household accounts from his presidency in Philadelphia and a lot of other accounting material. Henry Weinzick, who some of you may have heard since he's from the area and talks a lot about it, makes a big deal about Washington Washington freeing his slaves at the end of his life. And it is a big deal. It's important that Washington was doing that, at least in part, as Henry argues, as a attempt to influence other people. But another reason why Washington is one of the few founding fathers to actually act on the premise of equality and free as slaves is because he's one of the few founding fathers who was economically solvent enough as his debt to be able to do that. Jefferson certainly was not. I'm not sure that Jefferson would have anyway, but regardless, Jefferson had no chance. Washington did, and he acted upon it. So you can, if you select and you crib your quotes well enough, can paint Washington as a man who is very tight with a dollar, who is resentful of having to give money to his relatives, who is not above following policies that help his individual economic situation. But this is far from the whole story. In that same letter, he writes to that prospective steward describing how he's supposed to do the daily shopping and everything like that, and how he's supposed to put out the food for the day. And then he finishes by saying, Whatever remains after these purposes are served and is not necessary for the next day, I would have given to the poor and needy housekeepers in the area who may want but would not ask. Washington's account books, household account books of that period, I've looked through them. I found them kind of interesting. Are filled probably every week. There'll be a notation that says, "Gave a poor man a dollar, $2 to a needy woman, 50 cents to some to a beggar on the street." This to me suggests two things. One of which is dollars were worth a lot more in those days, which is true. It also suggests, of course, that Washington was very careful in watching where his money came. But it also means that he was giving a fair amount of money away in just sort of casual sorts of ways. Now, because the presidency was new and the government was new and a lot of people's idea of what the president was something like the monarch, George Washington got a lot of requests from people who wanted money, aid, assistance in the way that the king might grant you a boon. And his standard response to that was, my purse isn't big enough for that, and there are other sources. And in the case, let me put this in one specific example that I think is very interesting. In 1794 in Santo Domingo, there was a conflict between two Frenchmen who supported the revolution and Frenchmen who were less supportive of the revolution. And it resulted in a lot of Santo Domingo refugees showing up in the United States in late 1794. And Congress, in fact, voted them some money, and Washington had to administer that money. And various states and cities and such opened up private charities to support these refugees as they arrived in America. And in fact, Washington, in July of 1794, contributed $250, which is no small sum in those days, to the Philadelphia effort. And so when the various people requested things from him, he could say with truth, I've given, etc. This is not what the president does. We're not kings, that type of thing. However, In late 1794, two women from Santo Domingo, whose husbands were not with them, one, it turns out, had gone back to France to present a case. I'm not sure what happened to the other husband at the moment. Wrote him saying, oh, we're in terrible need. We need money. The typical letter. And somehow this one touched Washington. And I think his response, however, is very interesting and, again, very revelatory of this sort of funny relationship that Washington has with money and with charity and with everything else. Washington wrote a letter to him and sent them $25. He wrote the letter saying, I can't help everybody. I can't even help you fully. But for your immediate, you really should get in touch with the people in the Wilmington area who are involved in this charity, and there's money through the government and all this sort of thing. But for your immediate needs, here's $25. But he didn't send this letter directly to them. He sent it to a local politician whom he knew, a man named George Reed, who had been president, quote, governor of Delaware at one time. And he wrote him a letter, and he said, look, I get asked this all the time, and I've been imposed on some by frauds and all this sort of thing. I don't know exactly. I'm sending this letter open to you. Inquire. If these people, if these women are really in need, are really who they need to, really who they purport to be, please send the letter and the money to them. If not, don't. Washington believed in charity, but he believed in being very careful. There's another example that I just encountered in the volume I'm working on now. His brother, Samuel Washington, died when Washington was in his early adulthood. And Washington took on himself the support of the two boys that survived until they became of age. And he contributed, as he complains in the letter that I brought to look at, he complains somewhat bitterly about the expense of the estate, that he lost $800 practically right away, dealing with a bad land transaction that Samuel Washington had made. And then he has contributed more than 1,000 pounds to the support and upkeep of these boys to this point. And now, and this is why he's complaining a little bit bitterly, another kinsman by marriage, a man named David Stewart, who is executor of the estate of John Parke Custis, Martha's son, who has died young. Samuel Washington owes him about $1,000. And he's saying to Washington, you know, if you don't want the estate to be, would you be willing to stand up for this $1,000? And Washington's response is, again, I think, pretty interesting. He says, well, you know, he starts by complaining bitterly. You know, I've given, oh, I've given and I've given and I've given and I've given. And then he says, but I can't let this estate go into bankruptcy. I can't let all of the assets be sold or anything like that. So, yeah, you can count on me for the $1,000 if you need to. But don't tell anybody. Not only don't tell anybody, don't do anything until it becomes evident that the estate is about to be, that there's no other way out. Because I don't know, maybe there's something in the estate that I don't know about that they can resolve it short of that. I'm not convinced that these young people who are just coming of age and just taking care of just taking account of the estate for the first time themselves are sufficiently impressed with the liabilities against it and how little money there really is and all this sort of thing. I want them to worry. I want them to sweat before before I come in. It makes sense. He's a very careful man with his money. But what it comes right down to it, and this is the key point as far as I'm concerned, he's a very careful man with his money. He cares a lot about his money. But again, money is not the be-all and the end-all. He's willing to give it away, really. He's willing to do what he thinks is right rather than value money that much. What Washington really valued of the three things that I set out is fame. Or actually, fame is the wrong word. What Washington valued is the word that he himself would have used, which is reputation. Because it isn't just any sort of fame. It's not just being known. It's being known, admired by the right people for the right reasons. That's what Washington wanted more than anything else. The one thing that people who want to somehow claim that Washington was power-hungry can sometimes point to is his becoming commander-in-chief of the American Army. It's pretty clear that he wanted desperately to be commander-in-chief of the American Army. He tended to dress up in his military uniform during the debates about the whole thing. It's pretty clear he wanted desperately to do that. But again, it's clear to me also that the reason he wanted desperately to do that was because of the glory that could be won in leading America to victory and because of the proof of his status that would occur in the approbation of his fellow representatives in electing him to be officer on two levels. So Washington is a man who tends to make his decisions based on what he thinks will secure his reputation. And he's also a man who uses that control. Remember, I started out by contrasting Andrew Jackson, who was most uncontrolled, with George Washington, who is perhaps the most controlled president. He uses that control of his emotions, of his whole thing, in service of creating the image of the man of rectitude who will, in fact, behave properly and who is to be admired and who is to be trusted. And, for example, again, that retirement. The retirement, you could make an... Ed, the guy who talked to you last time and I were talking about his retirement from the Army, and I think we both agree that had Washington tried to follow the Napoleonic path, he would have faced remarkable opposition from other Americans of considerable strength of character who would not have liked that. He would have probably had the support of others, and it would have been a very disruptive thing. as I said, Ed, it was never a consideration. Washington was never interested in that. What he was interested in was managing his retirement in a way that would enhance his reputation. Washington was very aware of the Roman story of Cincinnatus, and he managed his retirement in a way that echoed Cincinnatus, going before the legislature, talking about how he wanted to go back to the simple life of a farmer that he had had before, how he was giving up power and that sort of thing. Washington was very good at managing his image. He was good at managing his image. That's another one of his strengths as a general. He was able to win the love of his subordinates, of both his officers and his men, by doing things like staying at Valley Forge, despite the fact that he was in many ways a harsh officer and a harsh employer. He was also able, for the most part, to manage it in such a way that the people who worked for him clearly respected and admired and followed him. Now, I don't want to pretend that this sort of managing his image in a way to contribute to his fame is entirely selfish. It's not. If you stop and think about it, Washington lives in an era in which the United States is the only democracy to begin with until the French Revolution, and in which countries are, for the most part, associated with their kings. And for the United States to take its proper place in the reputation of the world, it somehow had to have a figure like George Washington that could embody for the Europeans what the meaning of America was. And so that's the other benefit of what he was doing. He also used his retirement from the army to try and push another theme that was important to him, another theme that I think is important in his presidency, which is nationalism. Again, as I said, he spent much of his time trying to cajole the various states and the Continental Congress into supporting the troops in the way they needed to be supported. He, from very early on, believed in a strong national government. That's part of that Western thing again. From the point of view of developing the West, it was important to have a strong national government. From the point of view of national defense, it was important to have a strong national government. Washington was a supporter of the Constitution because it would strengthen the national government. He did not care for the sort of weak ideas of states' rights and the Articles of Confederation. So when the debates about Hamilton and Jefferson are going on, he doesn't support Hamilton's views ultimately because he's duped by Hamilton. He supports Hamilton's views because largely he agrees with Hamilton's views. He's a nationalist. Let me give you one other example of Washington as a politician, because I want to emphasize again that Washington was not a man who was easily led, a man who was a babe in the woods with regard to politics. This has to do with the selection of Valley Forge as the place for the winter encampment, a tough winter encampment, as we all know from our history. Prior to that, Washington held a council of generals, and he said to these generals, "I want all of your opinions about where we should stay for the winter campaign. You've got some choices. We can have a winter campaign. We can try and fight the British through the winter. That would have been very tough on the troops." He says, "We can try and move down towards Wilmington and stay near that city. We can move back into the interior of Pennsylvania along the line from Lancaster to Reading. Or we can hut somewhere in the Great Valley." That's to say, that's the Valley Forge option. They all sent in their results, and one of Washington's aides tabulated the results in a document. And according to that document, and it's an accurate document as far as I've been able to tell from reading the various letters to Washington about this, six or seven of the generals wanted to go to Wilmington. Nine of them wanted to move in the interior of Pennsylvania. One of them wanted to be in the Great Valley. One of them said we should hut in a strong position, which might be construed to support the notion of Valley Forge. And one of them, Pulaski, the hothead, wanted a winter's campaign. So Washington made the decision to go to Valley Forge against the advice of his generals. Now, why did he do that? It's really clear. It's really clear from his correspondence. It's really clear from his discussion. He went to Valley Forge for political reasons. He went to Valley Forge because if he went to either of the other two places, he feared that the Pennsylvania people would see themselves as being abandoned. By going to Valley Forge, he offered just enough protection to make sure that the Pennsylvania militia would stay active, to make sure that the Pennsylvania government would continue to see the Continental Army as a bulwark against the British, to see that the people who had been kicked out of Philadelphia by the British would still believe in the Continental Army's ability perhaps to get them back eventually. So he made that decision for political reasons, not for military reasons specifically. I mean, he couches it in you know, being able to prevent the British from getting supplies, and that's to some extent important, although he never they're never really able to prevent the British from getting supplies. It's mainly for the morale-boosting effect that it will have on the American people and the people of Pennsylvania in particular. Okay. We've talked a fair amount about what type of person Washington is. And I want to talk a little bit now about what supposedly my talk is about, the presidency. I want to approach the question to begin with of, did Washington want to be president? So it's a question that's debatable, is debated by historians. Washington himself, of course, claimed to be very reluctant, had to be persuaded, said, you know, I really like being a farmer at Mount Vernon, you know, I'm retired now, this sort of thing. And it made people convince him that he had to go. It is, however, I think pretty clear that Washington was too good a politician, was too cognizant of what was going on to think otherwise than when he went to the federal convention that formed the Constitution. He had to know that the only person who could be the president with enhanced powers at that time, the only person that everybody could agree on, would be him. And on one level, again, I think he really wanted that. He wanted it because it gave him another chance to build on his reputation, to again prove that he was a leader, that he was a man who would do right for America, that he was, as some historians have called him, the indispensable man. And again, I think that one of the reasons why people were unanimous, I mean, in wanting him to be president is not just because he was a famous military leader who had won the battle. God knows, Jackson, go back to Jackson, was a famous military leader who had won a famous battle that had, according to the eyes of most people, saved the United States, even if the battle took place after the war was theoretically over. Don't rely too much on that, because a lot of the peace would look very different had we lost the Battle of New Orleans, I assure you. But in any case, Jackson, Washington, military heroes, etc., nowhere near the unanimity about Jackson that there was about Washington. A lot of the reason why people believed in Washington was, I think, again, the people that were making that decision recognized that this is a man who would give up power and who would not abuse it. Because what he cared about was not his power, but his reputation. One thing probably that I've left out that I think is important about Washington is he's a man who is reasonably aware, given, you know, the amount of adulation that he got during his lifetime, of his own limitations. Reasonably aware and acknowledging of, I mean, he was always, for example, very concerned about the degree that to which he had less of a formal education than many of his contemporaries. He, as a military man, and he campaigned in a sense to become commander in chief, but as a military man, I think he understood quite well that he had not the background of the British generals he was facing. And one of the reasons that he relied on councils of officers is not just because that was the military way, but also because he genuinely wanted their opinion, their input, the input of other people, because he recognized that he wasn't the most experienced, most brilliant man who could make all these decisions on his own. This attitude, I think, had something to do with something that's very still a part of our government and that is not in the Constitution, is not somehow automatic, which is the existence of a cabinet. We have in the beginning of all of our presidential volumes a disclaimer. We say, you know, Washington never used the word cabinet. There's no real use of the word cabinet in this time by other people, but they function in the way that cabinets now function, that what we call the cabinet now function. The secretaries are called together for conferences. They debate the issues. Washington listens to all sides, again, giving Hamilton and Jefferson plenty of space to make the things that the historians pay attention to. And then they make a decision, which means ultimately, he makes a decision. They may feel that they've made the decision, but he's making that decision. So we have a cabinet system of government, which is a model. I mean, the British had a cabinet system, probably considerably different since it was reporting to the king. The cabinet system is somewhat similar to the councils of general officers that Washington was familiar with as a military man. It also expressed Washington's feeling of sort of humility that he didn't want to make decisions rashly on his own, jumping out in front of everybody. He wanted to hear all sides. He wanted to listen to the people whose minds he respected before making those decisions. Let me jump ahead so that I don't spend too much of your time. I'm already into 45 minutes. Let me quickly talk about the question of his retirement. There's a lot. I mean, the because Washington was this iconic figure, his retirement became really important. No president until Franklin Roosevelt, with the excuse of the war, tried to break Washington's precedent of retiring after two terms. The thing I would say is, so far, and I won't say this with absolute certainty until I've edited the volume that involves his retirement, which is yet to come, so far I see no great evidence that Washington thought he was or was trying to set a precedent in that way. Again, he manages his retirement in a way that, again, would enhance his reputation in terms of wanting to go back to Mount Vernon and give up power and the like. And God knows, Washington clearly cared about farming and about Mount Vernon. His weekly, detailed instructions to his overseers in the parts where that material survives are proof that he really cared about farming, as is his correspondence with British agriculturalists about experimental farming and the like. Washington was a very big exponent of scientific farming in America in this period of time. But his retirement, I think, actually had more to do with that interest in farming than it did with the notion of giving up power. Because, you see, I don't think Washington ever had to really be concerned about that. He really didn't care that much about the power. What Washington claimed, and I think, again, in this time not entirely honestly, to not want to have a second term. He claimed that he wanted to go back then. He let people persuade him not to. at the end of his second term, he again put himself in the, claiming to not want to go back. This time I think he meant it. Most clearly he meant it. That's why he went back. And I think he meant it not because he was concerned about the king and the two things and man for life and all that sort of stuff that we hear in the thing. I think he did it because he was tired. Moreover, his second term had not gone as well as his first term. There are a lot of controversial things, most notably the Jay Treaty with Great Britain, and there was a lot of criticism of it. Washington still could have been elected to a third term, don't kid yourselves, but he wouldn't have been elected unanimously anymore. And that would have been a blow to his reputation. He's still the only president who was unanimously elected twice. So there's that aspect of it. There's the aspect of the fact that he's 4 years older and getting closer to the time at which his life was going to run out. He wrote, even 4 years earlier, even as early as 1793, he had written to the British agriculturalist Arthur Young about the thought that he might give up management of Mount Vernon. He might sell Mount Vernon or at least rent it out, lease it out, to try and get a way of controlling the situation with having enough money to live on, having enough money to do, but not having to work as hard. And he wrote to Tobias Lear, if I can find this thing here, his close friend who was over in England at the time, to reinforce that and to explain in a little more detail than he was willing to go into with, I guess I won't be able to quote at the moment, so I'll just have to summarize for you, his reasons. And what he said was this: I'm interested in doing this because I don't want to have to, I'm getting older. I don't want to have to expend as much energy in the management of the estate as I've had to expend now. And I want, however, to do it in a way that will leave me enough money, and money's important to him, leave me enough money so that I can, and this is what's interesting, so that I can do the things that need to be done. And in particular, he says to Lear, he says, this is what he doesn't tell Young. He says, I get these calls for assistance that I feel that I can't meet. People think that I've got a wealthy estate, but I don't. He says, I want to retire. I want to retire in a way that I can meet those needs. And if I can sell my property, even though I love farming, and put myself in a retirement situation where I can meet the calls on me by people that I want to, that I feel that I ought to be able to. Remember, Washington has no children of his own, so calls on him are from his extended family or from the public at large. He's saying, if I can do that, I'm willing to step back. He said that in 93. Well, by 97, I think he was really tired and ready to go home. He hadn't been able to sell Mount Vernon, but he always liked farming anyway. So I think that's why he retired. I don't think it had a whole lot to do with power, because he didn't have to worry about that. He didn't really care about power.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.